21. The Land Cruiser bumped and lurched along a double rut of dust, the bushes brushing the underside of the chassis. Alan sat in front with Timmy, with his rifle upright between his knees. Marion followed hard after, with the ladies. We'd crossed a sandy gully and had to change to four-wheel drive. A black horse reared up, whinnied, and galloped off. On ahead, the country was open woodland. The trees made dark stripes of shadow over the grass and the ghost gums. At this orange hour of the evening seemed to float above the ground like balloons that had let down their anchors. Alan raised his hand for Arkady to stop, whipped the .22 through the window and fired into a bush. A female kangaroo and young broke cover and leaped away in great lolloping bounds, their haunches white against the grey of the scrub. Alan fired again and again. Then he and the man in blue jumped out and sprinted after them.
"Giant red," said Arkady. "They come out for water at sunset."
"Did he hit her?"
"Don't think so," he said. "Now, look, they're coming back."
Alan's hat showed up first, above the level of the grass heads. The man in blue's shirt was ripped at the shoulder, and he was bleeding from a thorn scratch.
"Bad luck, old man," said Arkady to Alan.
Alan recocked the rifle and glared from the window. The sun was touching the treetops when we came to a wind pump and some abandoned stock pens. There had been a settlement here in the old days. There were heaps of rotted grey timbers and the wreck of a stockman's house. The wind pump spurted a steady stream of water into two round galvanized tanks. A flock of galahs sat perched around the rim of the tanks, several hundred of them, pink-crested cockatoos, which flew up as we approached and wheeled overhead. The undersides of their wings were the colour of wild roses. Everyone in the party surrounded a drinking trough, splashed the dirt from their faces, and filled their water cans. I made a point of avoiding Marion, but she came up from behind and pinched me on the bum.
"Getting to learn the rules, I see," she grinned.
"Mad woman."
The country away to the east was a flat and treeless waste, entirely lacking in cover. Alan kept raising a finger to a solitary bump on the horizon. It was almost dark by the time we reached a small rocky hill, its boulders bursting with the white plumes of Spinifex in flower and a black fuzz of leafless mallee bush. The hill, said Arkady, was the lizard ancestor's resting place. The party split into two camps, each within earshot of the other. The men settled themselves and their swags in a circle and began talking in hushed voices. While Arkady unpacked, I went off to hack some firewood. I had lit the fire, using bark and grass for tinder, when we heard the sound of pandemonium from the women's camp. Everyone was shrieking and howling, and against the light of their fires I could make out Mavis hopping this way and that and gesturing to something on the ground.
"What's up?"
Arkady called to Marion.
"Snake,"
she called back cheerfully. It was only a snake trail in the sand, but that was snake enough to put the women into hysterics. The men, too, began to get twitchy. Led by Big Tom, they jumped to their feet. Alan recocked the .22. The two others armed themselves with sticks, scrutinized the sand, spoke in hoarse, emotional whispers, and waved their arms like hammy Shakespearean actors.
"Take no notice," said Arkady. "They're only showing off. All the same, I think I'll sleep on the roof of the Land Cruiser."
"Chicken," I said. For myself, I rigged up a snake-proof ground sheet to sleep on, tying each corner to a bush so its edges were a foot from the ground. Then I began to cook supper. The fire was far too hot for grilling steaks without charring them. I almost charred myself as well. Alan looked on with masterful indifference. None of the others gave one word of thanks for their food, but kept passing back their plates for more. Finally, when they were satisfied, they resumed their conference. "You know who they remind me of?" I said to Arkady. "A boardroom of bankers."
"Which is what they are," he said. "They're deciding how little to give us."
The steak was charred and tough, and after Hanlon's lunch we had very little appetite. We cleared up and went to join the old men's circle. The firelight lapped their faces. The moon came up. We could just discern the profile of the hill. We sat in silence until Arkady, judging the moment, turned to Alan and asked quietly in English,
So what's the story of this place, old man?
Alan gazed into the fire without twitching. The skin stretched taut over his cheekbones and shone. Then, almost imperceptibly, he tilted his head towards the man in blue, who got to his feet and began to mime, with words of pigeon thrown in, the travels of the lizard ancestor. It was a song of how the lizard and his lovely young wife had walked from northern Australia to the southern sea, and of how a southerner had seduced the wife and sent him home with a substitute. I don't know what species of lizard he was supposed to be, whether he was a Jew lizard or a road runner, or one of those rumpled, angry-looking lizards with ruffs around their necks. All I do know is that the man in blue made the most lifelike lizard you could ever hope to imagine. He was male and female, seducer and seduced. He was glutton, he was cuckold, he was weary traveller. He would claw his lizard feet sideways, then freeze and cock his head. He would lift his lower lid to cover the iris and flick out his lizard tongue. He puffed his neck into goiters of rage, and at last, when it was time for him to die, he writhed and wriggled, his movements growing fainter and fainter like the dying swan's. Then his jaw locked, and that was the end. The man in blue waved towards the hill and, with the triumphant cadence of someone who has told the best of all possible stories, shouted, That is where he is! The performance had lasted not more than 3 minutes. The death of the lizard touched us and made us sad, but Big Tom and Timmy had been in stitches since the wife-swapping episode and went on hooting and cackling long after the man in blue sat down. Even the resigned and beautiful face of old Alan composed itself into a smile. Then one by one they yawned and spread out their swags and curled up and went to sleep.
They must have liked you, Arcady said. It was their way of saying thanks for the food.
We lit a hurricane lamp and sat on a couple of camping chairs, away from the fire. What we had witnessed, he said, was not, of course, the real lizard song, but a false front or sketch performed for strangers. The real song would have named each waterhole the lizard man drank from, each tree he cut a spear from, each cave he slept in, covering the whole long distance of the way. He had understood the pigeon far better than I. This is the version I then jotted down. The lizard and his wife set off to walk to the southern sea. The wife was young and beautiful, and had far lighter skin than her husband. They crossed swamps and rivers until they stopped at a hill, the hill at Middlebore, and there they slept the night. In the morning they passed the camp of some dingoes, where a mother was suckling a brood of pups.
Ha, said the lizard, I'll remember those pups and eat them later.
The couple walked on, past Oodnadatta, past Lake Eyre, and came to the sea at Port Augusta. A sharp wind was blowing off the sea, and the lizard felt cold and began to shiver. He saw, on a headland nearby, the campfire of some southerners, and said to his wife, Go over to those people and borrow a fire stick. She went, but one of the southerners, lusting after her lighter skin, made love to her, and she agreed to stay with him. He made his own wife paler by smearing her from head to foot with yellow ochre, and sent her with the fire stick to the solitary traveller. Only when the ochre rubbed off did the lizard realise his loss. He stamped his feet. He puffed himself up in a fury, but being a stranger in a distant country, he was powerless to take revenge. Miserably, he turned for home with his uglier substitute wife. On the way he stopped to kill and eat the dingo puppies, but these gave him indigestion and made him sick. On reaching the hill at Middlebore, he lay down and died. And that, as the man in blue told us, was where he was. Arcady and I sat mulling over this story of an Antipodean Helen. The distance from here to Port Augusta, as the crow flew, was roughly 1,100 miles, about twice the distance, so we calculated, from Troy to Ithaca. We tried to imagine an Odyssey, with a verse for every twist and turn of the hero's 10-year voyage. I looked at the Milky Way and said, You might as well count the stars. Most tribes, Arcady went on, spoke the language of their immediate neighbour, so the difficulties of communication across a frontier did not exist. The mystery was how a man of tribe A, living up one end of a songline, could hear a few bars sung by Tribe Q, and without knowing a word of Q's language, would know exactly what land was being sung.
Christ, I said, are you telling me that old Alan here would know the songs for a country 1,000 miles away? Most likely.
Without ever having been there?
Yes.
One or two ethnomusicologists, he said, had been working on the problem. In the meantime, the best thing was to imagine a little experiment of our own. Supposing we found, somewhere near Port Augusta, a songman who knew the lizard song. Suppose we got him to sing his verses into a tape recorder and then played the tape to Alan in Katij country. The chances were he'd recognize the melody at once, just as we would the Moonlight Sonata, but the meaning of the words would escape him. All the same, he'd listen very attentively to the melodic structure. He'd perhaps even ask us to replay a few bars, then suddenly he'd find himself in sync and be able to sing his own words over the nonsense.
His own words for country round Port Augusta?
Yes, said Arkady.
Is that what really happens?
It is.
How the hell's it done?
No one, he said, could be sure. There were people who argued for telepathy. Aboriginals themselves told stories of their songmen whizzing up and down the line in trance. But there was another, more astonishing possibility. Regardless of the words, it seems the melodic contour of the song describes the nature of the land over which the song passes. So, if the lizard man were dragging his heels across the salt pans of Lake Eyre, you could expect a succession of long flats, like Chopin's Funeral March. If he were skipping up and down the MacDonald escarpments, you'd have a series of arpeggios and glissandos, like Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies. Certain phrases, certain combinations of musical notes, are thought to describe the action of the ancestors' feet. One phrase would say salt pan, another creek bed, spinifex, sandhill, mulga scrub, rock face, and so forth. An expert songman, by listening to their order of succession, would count how many times his hero crossed a river or scaled a ridge, and be able to calculate where and how far along a song line he was.
He'd be able, said Arkady, to hear a few bars and say, this is Middleboro, or that is Udnadatta, where the ancestor did X or Y or Z.
So a musical phrase, I said, is a map reference.
Music, said Arkady, is a memory bank for finding one's way about the world.
I shall need some time to digest that.
You've got all night, he smiled, with the snakes.
The fire was still blazing in the other camp, and we heard the burble of women's laughter.
Sleep well, he said.
And you?
I never had so much fun, he said, as I do with my old men.
I tried to sleep, but couldn't. The ground under my sleeping bag was hard and lumpy. I tried counting the stars around the Southern Cross, but my thoughts kept returning to the man in blue. He reminded me of someone. I had the memory of another man miming an almost identical story, with the same kind of animal gestures. Once, in the Sahel, I had watched some dancers mime the antics of antelopes and storks, but that was not the memory I was looking for. Then I had it. Lorenz,